Okay, I'm from the Naval Research Laboratory, which is here in this admittedly romanticized view of the place. It really doesn't compare to Santa Barbara, I'm sure you can tell. These images have been shown many times. I'm going to talk about our analysis of the million second observation of Cassiopeia A supernova remnant and some of the analysis of the earlier observations we did building up to that. The only thing I want to comment on these pictures is that the blast wave in Cassiopeia is delineated by this rim is roughly circular, which means, roughly speaking, that the circumstellar medium into which it is running, if it is a circular blast wave, is probably fairly uniform. This is, of course, outside of the, in inverted commas, jet region. Continue to refer to it as a jet region just for simplicity. A few vital statistics about the remnant. It's the youngest galactic core collapse remnant that we know about. It's well studied at all energies, I mean from radio through to TeV gamma rays. It is observed with the exception of the extreme ultraviolet. Distance about 3.5 kiloparsecs. My favorite explosion date is sometime in the 1660s. My models work best that way. Forward shock radius is, forward shock speed, 5,000 to 6,000 kilometers per second. Radius about 2.5 parsecs. Ratio of the forward and reverse shock radii varies around the remnant, and it's in this range here, 1.5 to 1.8. We've got approximately 2 solar masses of ejecta. This number varies depending on who you believe. And the ejecta dominate the X-ray emission in the Chandra observation, and they often appear as knots in the X-rays. Our assumption about the progenitor is it's something like 20, 25 solar masses. It's down to 4 solar masses upon explosion. Patrick Young will have a lot more to say about the progenitor of Cassiopeia on Friday morning. It's running into a stellar wind. Here you see a bright ejector ring, which corresponds to this spike in the density here in the numerical model by Shirode and Oishi. This is the forward shock, this is the reverse shock, this is the contact discontinuity. Uniform density interstellar medium does not give this strong density spike. And given this degree of mass loss, there ought to be a wind that it's running into. Okay, I'm going to follow roughly the same format that Rob Friesen did. I'm going to talk about how we analyze ejector knots in X-rays, not optical. I'm going to talk a little bit about what happens in equatorial regions and to motivate some analysis of what we believe is going on at the tip of the, whatever you want to call this, I'll keep calling it a jet. This is the initial data we were working from. This is a 50,000 second observation with Chandra. This is the million second, and I'll say more about the differences a little bit later on. Okay, why do we look at knots? The first reason for doing this is that the size scale of the knots is around 1 arc second, or 0.02 parsecs, so that the reverse shock of around 2,000 kilometers per second goes through a knot in about 10 years. Therefore, we can isolate the emission from each ejector knot. We sometimes have to play clever games with the background subtraction to do that. But once we've done that, we can usually say that it is shocked on the time scale of the evolution of the remnant, it is shocked instantaneously. Therefore, we ought to be able to fit the spectrum with a single temperature and a single ionization age, which is the integral of electron density over time since the shock passage. We can then interpret these fits if we have a hydro model. However, we do have to make an assumption about the density in the knots. Most people, and myself included, when they see dense knots, or see, well, let's say dense emission from knots, assume that the knots are over-dense. They must be clumps of material. However, this doesn't really work. The knots have roughly the same temperature as what's around them. They're all similar temperature heating X-rays. So that a shock going through a dense knot ought to slow down. And this is what why the optical knots emit optical, because they are dense, and then the shock has slowed down to temperatures where optical emission is dominant. In X-rays, the shock has to go through roughly the same speed. So that would give you some idea that maybe the knots are not overdense. They must be similar to what's around them. The second reason is shown here. This is a simulation from Richard Klein. This is a shock has come down from the top down to the bottom here. And this is a knot, an overdense knot that went through the shock. And you see it begin to be shredded by hydrodynamic instabilities following the shock. And this is largely due to the fact that the knot is accelerated differently to the surrounding material. Our knots in Cas A are resolved spatially, and we see nothing like this. This knot is roughly 10 or 100 times overdense. A factor of 2 or 3 doesn't make much difference. It won't make much difference to our analysis either, but you're looking for significant overdensities. Now, this is not just a theorist's construction. This really happens. Here is an image that Una is too modest to show you, but I thought I'd do it anyway. This is from the Puppis A supernova remnant. This is a cloud that went through, that was hit by the blast wave. This is a knot that corresponds to here. This is the shredding. And then this is another knot that's just gone through the shock wave here. This physics really happens. And if you read this paper, you'll see how the progress of the instability can be used to try and measure shock speed, ages, things like this. The scale here, I don't know offhand. Can Una? On the order of parsec, yeah. Okay, knot spectra, what do they look like? Now, these are all from the 50,000 second observations. This is what has been called a silicon-rich knot. I believe, in fact, it's oxygen-rich, and we don't see any oxygen lines. Oxygen contributes mainly to the continuum. The ionization age is 3 by 10 to the 10. The temperature is 1.5 keV, and this is a knot that will turn out to have been shocked around 120 years after the explosion. So it's a reverse shock, hit it at around, I guess, 1800 or so, 1790. At a temperature of 1.3 keV in collisional ionization equilibrium, silicon should be dominated by the hydrogen-like charge state or the bare nucleus. However, here we see very clearly that the silicon is in the helium-like charge state, that the peak is at about 1.83 keV. The reason why you see helium-like and not hydrogen or bare nucleus is that this plasma is not in ionization equilibrium. It is still ionizing to get there. If we go to a knot that has a slightly higher ionization age, 1.8 by 10 to the 11, we can look again at the inset of the silicon line. We see the hydrogen-like line starting to appear at 2 keV. So we have something here that we can use as a timing signature to estimate when knots went through shocks. And hopefully with a hydrodynamic knot model, we can place knots within the within the ejector, give it a Lagrangian mass coordinate. You can also see that the iron line also moves. Here, this is an iron line of neon-like or fluorine-like iron, 800 eV, and it's now at about a keV. That's carbon-like. The iron ionization balance is moving as the ionization progresses. Down here, I show a couple of the iron-rich knots, much higher ionization ages. And you can see the difference between the so-called pure iron and a more typical iron-rich knot, which has more of the silicon, sulfur, argon, calcium. So how do we proceed? This is just amplifying what I said before. Here are the silicon charge states, an example of how the ionization balance evolves following shock passage. And in principle, what we could do, take the observed ionization balance, read off this plot here, or a plot like it, where the ionization balance is correct, and then read off the time since the shock passage. So this is one key component of the analysis, understanding the knots and being able to fit them with single temperatures and ionization ages. The other key thing that made this possible was a nice paper from 1999 by Truelove and McKee, who give basically an analytic recipe for hydrodynamic models for supernova remnants. Most of their work concentrated on the interstellar medium case, so we had to extend it for the 1 over r squared circumstellar medium. They use a parameterization for the ejector density profile. It has a uniform density core and a power law envelope. And the power law envelope becomes in the limit of explosion energy deposited right in the center of the ejector, that the ejector power law will be a very steep, almost a completely uniform ejector. As the explosion energy is deposited further throughout the ejector, the power law becomes shallower. So we couple this with a time-dependent ionization balance and use the analytic hydrodynamics to evolve the ionization balance of the shocked elements. So this is all coupled to equations for the ionization balance with radiative and adiabatic losses, electron ion temperature equilibration via Coulomb collisions only. We adjust the explosion energy and ambient density and so on to get a good match to the observed parameters of CAS A. And at this point, I'll say, although this has all been analytic, we do get very good agreement with the independent and numerical model of Chevalier and Oishi. This is something that sort of worries me from time to time, that there's not really been much to check against. Okay, here are a few models. They're all specified to give the same blast wave radius, blast wave velocity and radius and core density. So we're taking a different 1D model in different directions around the remnant. N equal 9 is our standard model, which accounts for most of the remnant. As you go to shallower power laws, you need more explosion energy in this particular direction to get the same blast wave radius and velocity. Okay, all this is put together in a code. The code that we use is called Blasphema. I use it for many of my more controversial ideas, the solar wind, laboratory shockwaves. In fact, the idea is that it's a contrived acronym, Blast Propagation in Highly Emitting Environment from Radiative Shocks. This is repeating some of what I said. Now, Carlos will give a talk about the problems we have in interfacing atomic physics and radiative cooling with hydrodynamics. We're just using the simple prescription here. I also made the point that collisionless electron ion equilibration has been neglected. This is a fascinating subject. I could give another talk about that, but the other people like Parviz and Sandra Chapman will give talks on Thursday that relate to this, and Cara may say something about it on Friday. And the way we proceed, we plot the electron temperature against ionization age at the current epoch for knots that went through the reverse shock at different times in the evolution of the remnant. And we compare those with the knot fits. Here's the result that Jack's already shown. These are the curves for different ejector models. Roughly speaking, this branch of the curve here corresponds to the reverse shock when it's propagating through the core of the ejector profile. And then this branch is when it's going through the outer envelope. And this point at the highest ionization age is the core envelope boundary. Notice that we get somewhere, the maximum NET with these models is somewhere in the 10 to the 12 range. For models down here, N equal 9, N equal 12, this point has gone right down to the floor. The ejector has become radiatively unstable, and it cools all the way. For N equal 5.5 and N equal 6, you should follow the dotted curves. If you recall the figure at the beginning, the knots from the jet, so-called jet base, this is still at a region where, still in a place where the forward shock is still roughly circular. They lie along these shallower curves. The points are plotted such that the uncertainty in the point gives the size of the symbol, which unfortunately attracts your eye to the most uncertain points. You should be aware that there are several rather good points here. As you move further away from the polar axis, you start to populate points down here. So we're seeing a shallower power law close to the presumed jet, which implies more explosive energy going in that direction. We can play the same game with the iron-rich knots. This box is the iron, the almost pure iron cloud. And then these points here are the more normal iron-rich knots. Notice that though we've got a large uncertainty in this point, basically we don't see anything out here where it would be thermally predictably thermally unstable. So we see everything up to where we expect to see iron, but not beyond. Knots out here, if they existed, would be very luminous in the one waveband we cannot observe, the extreme ultraviolet. The iron will cool it transitions around 200 angstroms. We're seeing a total, a few percent of the total iron that we expect from our mass sensors here. So we expect that most of the iron that the supernova ejected would still be inside the reverse shock. We don't think that much of it could have got out beyond what we see. A short word about where the knots come from. This is a figure that was given to me by Amy Hungerford, part of her thesis. This is taking a cone of the supernova ejector and giving it roughly three times the velocity, expansion velocity of the surroundings. I think that's right, three times expansion velocity. And it blows out and starts to fragment by Rayleigh-Taylor instability at the front of the iron blowout. And you see it produces a knotty structure. If this is what is producing the knots we're seeing here, then we would be seeing just the outer layer here that has currently gone through the reverse shock. Most of this would still be interior to the reverse shock. We've heard a lot of discussion about asymmetries, various causes of asymmetry in the remnant. But the lobes of iron emission seen here, well, it's appealing to think of them as the result of these standing accretion shock instabilities, or helical one or helical two modes. Our thought is that when you look at these diagrams, this is about the limit of what we could do with 50,000 seconds of data to work with. With the million second observation, we'll be able to populate diagrams like this with many more points and many more higher quality points. The fit uncertainties will get smaller and smaller. We will have Doppler shifts from the higher statistics. We will have position in the plane of the sky just from the imaging. And we will have Lagrangian mass coordinates from the departures from ionization equilibrium and the hydrodynamic modeling. So we'll be able to reconstruct something like a three-dimensional distribution of knots. Now, it's not really model independent. We still need the 1D models to get the mass coordinates. But we will have something like a catalog of maybe 100 or more knots to work with. And we can then go and talk to theorists and say, can you make an explosion which places these elements at these places in the ejector, in the Lagrangian mass coordinates? So for the time being, I don't want to think too hard about exactly what asymmetries we are seeing, but to just progress with the data analysis. However, having made this preliminary, I want to say a little bit more about the knots, what we think we see in the jet. Now, when we wrote the proposal for the very large project, this was late 2002, early 2003, I think we didn't mention the connection with gamma ray bursts at all, and we maybe mentioned the jet once or twice. It was a very minor part of our proposal. We talked about doing supernova nucleosynthesis and asymmetric explosions, of course, but at the time of the writing the proposal, the only gamma ray burst core collapse connection was SN1998BW and 980415 gamma ray burst. Most of the things we've heard about at this conference are from the next two connections, the lines and gamma ray bursts, all happened 2002-2003, so they hit the literature a little bit after this proposal. So this is something that we hadn't really prepared to do, but we decided to look at the jet first, partly because it's a slightly easier data analysis thing to try, and partly because the fashion, if you want to call it that, changed. I'm going to concentrate basically on these three knots at the outer edge of the X-ray emission here. These three knots are just not visible on the 50,000 second observation. There's nothing there. You have to go for 20 times more exposure to find them. The other thing to remark is that the blast wave is actually not visible in this region. We have a few ideas why this might be. It has been suggested that maybe we should have asked for 2 million seconds or 3 million seconds, but even so, I'm skeptical we would have found it. The blast wave here is illuminated mainly in continuum, which we take to be synchrotron emission from cosmic ray electrons. And here, of course, the shock would be oblique in the sense that the incoming gas is not coming along the shock normal, and cosmic ray acceleration is much less effective in such a case. So this is probably why we're not seeing the blast wave there. Okay, we've had a... here's the spectrum of the outermost jet knots. The main thing to notice here, the ionization age is 10 to the 13. This is much higher than anything else we've seen in the Cassay remnant. Okay, thank you. And the plasma appears to be very close to ionization equilibrium. So this is already implying high densities. John Blondin gave us a nice impassioned plea to not forget about circumstellar cavities. There's good reason to believe that a polar axis, there may be a cavity in the circumstellar material around Cassay, and if there were, one would get a jet of ejector as the star exploded. The other possibility we consider is a true jet explosion from Alexei Kokhlov. And so I want to consider these two possibilities. Although we don't see the blast wave in this region, I'm going to assume for the purposes of the cavity that it's here, that it's very close to where the knots are. If we do that, we find that this is a radius of about 3.8 parsecs. To get that, we need roughly 8 times less density in the circumstellar medium than elsewhere. And if we run the models, admittedly were still 1D models, but for this density, we find that the traces of temperature against ionization age look like this. The maximum ionization age is now slightly lower than it was before. John may say it ought to be the same. Here are the fits to the knots. We could maybe increase the temperature here if we were willing to have collisionless electron ion equilibration. That would increase the electron temperature here, but we cannot get to the knots right at the tip. Okay, trying the jet, we use a slightly different model now. This is still Truelove and McKee hydro, but with a different ejector density. It's just 1 over R all the way out. We use roughly the same salt equivalent spherical salt ejector mass we had before. The isotropic energy is chosen to be this number. That places knots cooling through the observed temperature. These knots at that jet energy will be cooling through the right temperature at the right place. This would then place the blast wave outside of the field of view. So when we do that, we get something like this. We can find a model that goes all the way through the points. Of course, we have complete freedom in specifying our jet model to find something that works. Because we don't know where the blast wave is, we can assume it to be anywhere we like. Importantly, I think it's these three knots that are really constraining the conclusion. The dashed curve here shows the result of taking one of these three curves correspond to different abundance sets observed in different knots. If we took oxygen out of the continuum and replaced it with hydrogen, the temperature comes down to here. but just to show you what happens. So as a tentative conclusion that we have some asymmetry in the explosion that is responsible for the polar morphology of Cassay, not an asymmetry in the circumstellar medium. Some problems about how the jet sustains itself in the supernova remnant phase. Ordinarily, one would expect the high pressure behind the blast wave to give you a short sound crossing time, and it would naturally want to equilibrate, and the blast wave would become spherical. This comes from something called the Compagnetz approximation. In the jet, or in the polar region, you never get to the Sedov-Taylor phase, or you get there much later, because most of the shocked circumstellar medium flows non-radially and down the jet, and so you do stay ejector-dominated in the polar region much longer. The second problem, second thing that helps us here, is that there is always cold plasma there, which will retain some memory of the initial explosive asymmetry. This is either a cold, unshocked ejector, or shocked ejector that is already cooled by thermal instability. The knots that we're observing are modeled here to be about 50% of the way out. So there's already a lot of mass at the head of the polar protrusion that is cold. Of course, detailed hydrodynamics is clearly required to make much progress. Gross energetics may be right, but a lot of details are quite possibly wrong. Here is an example from laboratory jets. This is from a paper by Foster et al. It's produced at the Omega Laser. You can see lots of structure in here. They've tried to model it with hydro simulations. This is a hydro simulation process to look like the data. This is a more accurate rendering of the densities. And you see there's lots of structure in here, shocks banging backwards and forwards. We need something like that before we can make real further progress on the jets. Fortunately for us, Alexei Hoklov and Inma Dominguez have become interested in this and are beginning to try that. I hope they stay interested. Okay, a few concluding thoughts. The knots in Cassay turn out to be crucial in many ways. It really simplifies the assumption of our analysis of the X-ray data. There's an unusual application of atomic physics here. This is really using the ionization balance as the crucial diagnostic, and it's something that needs to be implemented into hydrodynamics in order for us to be able to compare real theory with the Chandra observations. This is a little bit of propaganda for my supervisors at NRL who think I ought to be doing something different, using spectroscopy to do something else, and contrast with the traditional spectroscopy techniques. Okay, I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Martin, I have two questions for you. Yes. First one, you talked about all the models that you had done with different ends and stuff. I'm just wondering, there must be quite a bit of degeneracy in there depending on how much energy you put in and what density you assume for the surrounding, depending
actually,
on what the constraints
no,
you want.
As you go back, let's see if I can find that.
Well, so what are the constraints that you put to?
Okay. You have to get blast wave velocity right, blast wave radius right, reverse shock or ratio of reverse shock to blast wave.
But how well do you know the ratio of reverse shock to blast wave, for example?
You don't know
how
that
well do you
well,
know?
But yeah. 1.5 to 1.8 is the sort of range you're talking about.
Yeah, but that'll actually, you can fit that with a lot of ejector models which will give you that.
Yeah, now there are other constraints too. We know that the emission measure of the shocked circumstellar medium tells us that there are 10 solar masses of shocked circumstellar material. That tells you what the circumstellar density has to be. So it comes out at about 2 hydrogen atoms or equivalent density in front of the blast wave at the current epoch.
It's about 2, you said?
About 2 at the current epoch. So it's... I've tried all sorts of many different things, and this is what works. The degeneracy is not as severe as you think.
No, because, I mean, even if you look at your plots, the velocities, I mean, there's only a 10% difference among the...
Well, these are designed to give you the same velocity.
Yeah, but if you change the energies, you could get some.
You get different velocities, you could, but then other things go wrong too. This is why I prefer 1660 for the explosion date rather than 1680, because you get both velocity and the radius right. This is done for 1680 actually, and you see it's not quite right.
But I mean, we can't really choose the explosion dates.
So. No, but I do get significantly better parameters with an earlier explosion date.
Okay, and one more question I had was, in that sort of jet region that you talk about, do you have any clue where the reverse shock is at all around there?
No. We
you have even an idea of where you could...
No idea.
Can you... You know the reverse shock in some other regions from like the HST that people have. Can you actually even try to track it at all?
In here, there's no hope, I think, of really locating the reverse shock. You can do it in laboratory jets, and you can see a reverse shock propagating through the mushroom cap and down.
I think this would help distinguish between some models if you could at least tell approximately.
I don't know if there's any hope of finding the reverse shock.
Okay.
I have a general question. Maybe you will answer it, or maybe somebody else who works with this data. Do we have a three-dimensional picture of this object so we can turn it and go around, like, you know, three-dimensional simulations? In particular, I'm interested, how do we know that there is just one jet? Maybe there's a jet facing going towards us or away from us.
Well, there is evidence of a counter jet down
here. No, but how about things, you know, going directly towards us or away from us?
Most of that comes from the optical emission that you see. If there was stuff coming towards us,
right,
there ought to be highly blue shifted knots.
So
blue shifted with 14,000 miles per second, and those are not visible.
That's
just don't see it. You see high velocity knots going this way and this way, but coming towards us, the knots are...
So that has been done.
They're not
okay,
extreme
that was
high
my
velocity.
Question.
Just a couple of comments. One, you might like 1660, but it could not have exploded any farther back than 1671, plus or minus 1 year.
Okay.
That's
I
assuming
said 1660s that, is what I said, but
that's assuming no deceleration.
Yes.
Okay. And that's been published. That was published.
So let's take 1670 as a
five years ago, and that assumes no deceleration. The two questions I have is, in terms of the reverse shock, you assumed 2,000 kilometers per second.
No, that's just an example.
Is it important to choose one number versus another?
Well, the reverse shock velocity comes from the models, and it's typically, in my models, around 1,500 kilometers per second.
Okay.
What I care about most is the reverse shock a few years after explosion, or 50 to 100 years after explosion, not so much the reverse shock at the current epoch. And it should slowly accelerate during the core phase, but it's held constant in my models.
Because there's some data that's been published, actually, that says it's 3,000 and maybe up as high as 5,000 in some places.
Yeah, it's possible.
Okay. And then just last point or question, did you see any abundance variation in the jet?
There are abundance variations. Most of what we see here looks like a typical oxygen or silicon-rich knot. There is some iron, but certainly not iron-rich. I believe in the northern jet filament we see iron equivalent width increasing as you move out. But again, it's not significantly iron rich. There could be iron out in the unseen region, but you know, we have no idea.
My question here. My question consists of two parts. The one is, do I conclude correctly that those knots are most likely not due to some cavity in the environmental medium, but come from some origin in the explosion?
Yes, that's our conclusion, yes.
And second...
With the caveat that it's all done with 1D hydrodynamics of the simulation, you know, because we don't have the full numerical hydro yet. And even post-processing, say John's simulation, wouldn't really help. Well, it would help a little bit. But if radiative cooling becomes important, it's got no.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so I think the second part is much more uncertain. You would not dare to draw conclusions on whether models can be excluded or can be commented on.
We have a tentative, a tentative conclusion is that we favor the explosive asymmetry, to give it, not to call it a jet, but it really needs to be done in full rigor. I don't think it can be that. I mean, the energy we infer in this so-called jet is around 10 to the 50 ergs, which is not sufficient to explode the star. It's about an order of magnitude less than what Alexei had.
Concerning the lack of synchrotron emission from the bow shock in this area, you said that this was possibly because the shock is oblique. But is anything known about the magnetic field direction there, or did you mean oblique in some other sense?
There are measurements of the magnetic field elsewhere in the blast wave of Cassay, and I think Jaco will say a little bit about that. We have no idea, if we can't see the blast wave, we can't try and estimate what the magnetic field is from the X-rays.
No radio information, right?
Not that I know of. Okay.
Yeah, just wanted to make a comment about your desire to look at the big picture, which is, I agree, is very important. The forward shock in this remnant is almost certainly putting a large fraction of its energy into cosmic rays, and that will change the hydrodynamics, significantly.
The models I used are adiabatic models, there's no cosmic ray, but it does give a good representation of the forward shock, contact discontinuity, separation.
So how complete, I mean, how reliable can you estimate the energy of the jet, and also maybe also the ejector, to rule out or support any models?
I would say at the moment we have the order of magnitude probably about right, but not much better than that.
So your number of 10 to the 50
are... And that's, if anything, an overestimate.
That's probably a lower limit. Is that a lower limit?
That will be an upper limit. If 10 to the 50 or down into 10 to the 49 range is the sort of energy we're talking about. That's at the kinetic energy at the current time.
Upper limit in the sense, in what sense it is, it's just you think you have estimated from the,
the way it's estimated is we take an equivalent isotropic explosion energy to place these knots at the right place, cooling through the right temperature at year 2004. And then you take an estimate of the jet opening angle. And that gives you the total energy in the jet. So you're going from 2.3 by 10 to 52 equivalent isotropic energy down to 10 to the 50 or something less, because it's not isotropic. It's just a small solid angle of jet here.
All right.
That's where it's coming from. It will be revised as we get better hydrodynamics, but that's what I can do for the time being.
I wonder about the basic picture. The is the temperature behind the shock, what you call shock wave, is the one which is predicted by the shock. Are the ratios of the line widths, which you see in X-rays, ratios that you expect from temperature, from single temperature and so forth, before going to interpret?
Behind the blast wave, we see the temperature behind the blast wave, the electron temperature reserve, is what we expect from the shock jump conditions for electrons and ions with the appropriate abundances and Coulomb equilibration.
Equilibration, but equilibration takes a very long time.
The shock is 5,000 kilometers per second. That heats ions to, depending on their mass, to 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 10 degrees Kelvin. So the initial equilibration up to around 10 to the 7 or a few by 10 to the 7 is very fast. You're not completely equilibrating electrons and ions. You get the electrons up to around a few keV temperature quickly, and then it gets much known.
Now, what about the ratios of the line widths?
We haven't got line widths. These are all CCD spectra. We can't measure the line width. Now, at other shocks in other supernova remnants which have been observed with grating instruments, you can measure line widths. And the widths agree with the shock velocity. I think Parviz will talk a little bit about that on Thursday. For example, SN1006, you see a fast shock and you see nice lines that correspond to the shock velocity. Yes, this has all been done.
Yeah, last sure. question.
So if you find knots with 10 to the 13 NET, just a quick calculation shows you then that the NE is of something like 1,000, right?
Yes.
Does it match also the emission measure of the knots?
In practice, when we try to measure the emission measure of a knot and extract a density that way, it comes out the same order of magnitude but slightly lower.
Okay.
Factors of 2 or 3 are the sort of numbers
so
I carry around.
So that's quite a lot. 1,000.
Yes.
Okay.
And in fact, I mean, these knots are not 1,000 density at the current epoch. It's a little bit lower than that, and they were more dense earlier in the evolution. Most of the NET comes from the early evolution.
Thank you.
Okay.
Let's thank the speaker again. So now is